Mishkanos, which grow from trees. Trees, in turn, come from the ground. So, in a sense, it is true that an apple is the fruit of the earth. The tree did grow out of the earth. And therefore, this mistake, this incorrect bracha, b'dieved, is satisfactory. One does fulfill one's obligation with that. But the other way around, of course, is not true. If on a potato, you incorrectly say, borei pri ha'etz, well, potatoes, in no sense, grow from trees. It's simply not true in any sense, and therefore one does not fulfill one's obligation at all. So let's take the simple case. We'll come to the more complicated case in a moment. The simple case is, I have before me a fruit, a vegetable. I don't know exactly what it is. I've never seen something like this before. I don't know whether the correct bracha is borei pri ha'etz or borei pri ha'adama, but I do know that borei pri ha'adama will work. Since I know that borei pri ha'adama will work, it's correct to make the bracha borei pri ha'adama. Now let's talk about the more complicated case. The case in which I don't know a bracha which will work at all. Maybe this is neither borei pri ha'etz nor borei pri ha'adama, or perhaps I simply don't know any brachas. I can't remember them. I always read them from a piece of paper. I don't have my piece of paper with me, and I simply cannot recite the bracha. I simply don't know it. Well, since the obligation of reciting brachas is an obligation lechatchila, which you are initially supposed to do before you eat, but b'dieved, if you have already eaten without reciting the bracha, it is still correct to go on and recite an after bracha if you know one. The rule is as follows. Whenever there is an obligation, lechatchila, to do something in halacha, but b'dieved, after the fact, if you have failed to fulfill your obligation, all is well. In these situations, if for some reason you cannot fulfill your halachic obligation, which you're supposed to do, you can go ahead and eat the food without a bracha if you are unable to recite the correct bracha. And now this situation can arise in a number of cases. The case that you described is a fairly bizarre one, fairly unusual. It's unusual to find people who are simply incapable, simply don't know any brachas which might be appropriate. It can happen. And this is the halacha which would apply in their case. More commonly, but not very common, are people who cannot recite brachas because they are in places which are not clean, or they themselves cannot become clean. People with certain digestive illnesses, people who find themselves stuck in places where there are feces, and they have no way of leaving that. They're stuck in bed. They cannot move. There's no one available to clean the room at the moment. And therefore, a bracha cannot be recited because of the presence of feces. If in these fairly unusual cases, if they do arise, if a bracha cannot be recited, you don't have to starve to death. You don't even have to wait for a life-threatening situation. You can go ahead and eat without brachas.
Another question. There's a bracha you can make on I just heard this like yesterday, someone was talking about this. A bracha you can make naked on an Arab?
Men or women?
Men.
Men cannot recite brachas without clothes on. No, men are shaped differently than women. Men cannot recite brachas without pants on, without trousers. Women is a different situation, but for men there's really no possibility for that. Yes.
Back to the business at hand, as it were, in a case where a person was collecting money for tzedakah, and that money was stolen from him, is he obligated to pay back to the Gemah what was stolen under his
In general, not. The din would depend upon whether or not he was negligent. If he guarded the money, according to standards of guarding, whatever would be considered acceptable guarding for that money, and nonetheless it was stolen, then he's off the hook. If, on the other hand, he was negligent, then he has to pay back. For example, if we're talking about a small sum, and he kept it in his pocket, the way people normally keep that sum of money in their pocket, and a pickpocket got him, he's off the hook. But if he left that small sum on a table in a restaurant and walked away and someone stole it, so he was negligent, he didn't guard that money the way people normally guard that sum of money, and he's guilty, he'll have to repay. If it's a larger sum of money and he left it in his suitcase in the hotel room, and most people would put that amount of money not in their suitcase in the hotel room but in the hotel safe, then again, he's guilty of negligence. On the other hand, if he did put it in the safe of the hotel, which most people would do with that sum of money, and nonetheless, a burglar came in and emptied out the safe, he's off the hook because he did take the normal precautions of guarding the money. That's what the din would depend upon. Yes.
What is the problem for us to make on the rice cake?
A rice cake. There are different opinions. Some people say shahakol, some people say borei pri hadama, and some people say borei minei mezonos. Now, anyone who's making any of these brachas is following a legitimate opinion. Each of them have different reasons why they hold what they hold, but the poskim are divided on exactly this issue. All of these are correct. Yeah.
I have two questions. One is very relevant for morning, the Shabbat. So I don't live in Yeshiva, I live in a very public area in Old City, and I have a little bit of a few steps from my door, and I want my menorah out. And this year, I have from last year a nice menorah, and I'm afraid that if I light it, and I leave it on my porch, and I'm not there, and I leave it like in a whole Shabbat, especially, like when I stop in, go here and there, I come back, it's a very, very good chance to get stolen. So it's like if I put it on, it's a little tricky because what I want to use as a crystal, can I use it as a basis? I have when I put something else down on top of the serpent. But in addition, the thing I think is also a drum, which I know is a musical instrument in Mosa. I don't know how to play, unless it just feels like a big box, like a platform, but it's a kind of drum. And so can I designate that for another purpose on Shabbat and not make a Mosa? And in addition, if I make it, put another thing on it,
First of all, as I'm sure you know better than I, the minhag of Chabad is not to light outside the house at all. But those who are following the more common Yerushalmi minhag of lighting outside the house, that also is a legitimate minhag, perhaps even a more common minhag. If you are afraid that the Chanukiah is going to be stolen, the simplest approach would be to use a cheaper Chanukiah. That would be a simple approach. But as far as the halacha is concerned, here are the principles. Number one, the Chanukiah, the menorah, is going to be supported by something that might be a drum, I understand.
So this
drum, assuming the worst, that it is a musical instrument, if you are using it as the basis to hold up the Chanukiah, then the drum is not mukta, and you can move it. The problem is that the Chanukiah itself becomes mukta because of the flames which are burning on it. So the Chanukiah, the menorah itself is mukta, and anything which is supporting it also becomes mukta. Therefore, what you have to do is place something on the drum, on the base, which is holding up the Chanukiah. You have to put something else on this base, which is more valuable than the Chanukiah. If the second object which you put on the base is more valuable than the Chanukiah, then the base can be moved. You'll move the base together with the Chanukiah, and you can put it into the house. but this probably won't solve your problem, since you're leaving not only the Chanukiah in the public domain, but an additional object which is worth even more. So this just runs directly against your whole purpose here.
About one is 24 hours and one is like an hour.
Okay, if you want to stand outside and watch it for the hour that it's burning, and then grasp the base and move the whole thing into the house, including the Hanukkah menorah plus the other object which is worth more, that is permitted to do.
Because I can go up and say, if it's time that I'll be going to Dub, and all of the passing by Kabbalah Shabbat, there's a smaller chance I can take it than maybe in the wee hours of the night, like 2-3 in the morning.
So you can decide what to do. I think the best thing to do would be to use a cheaper menorah.
And the last one, yeah, thing is, I'm making a challenge for Shabbat, so I want to make a, I don't know, something where like, there's three conditions needed to make it not promoted to the donut. So if I have, I want to make like a Hanukkah shaped bread.
And you want it to be mezonos.
So I'm thinking, if I put like, how, what does it work? I make dough and then small, and have like a, put something inside like a jelly or something, and then is it thin? Is it okay? Or has to be more?
You want it to be mezonos.
Yeah, or I want it to be not a stuffing, and mostly what people would be getting a little rough.
If you make dough and you want to bake it into something which you want to be mezonos, and not hamotzi, I'll start with the non-Chabad approach, which is probably more directly interesting for you. The rule is as follows. If the final product is crispy, like a cracker, as opposed to soft, like cake, it'll be borim and mezonos. Also, if the dough has mixed into it sugar, cinnamon, cocoa, oil, anything which is noticeable in the final taste, then you have cake and not mezonah and not lechem. Borim and mezonos will be the correct bracha. Now, up until now, everything is good for Chabad and good for everyone else. The last point is a little bit controversial. The final point is that if it is baked or fried together with the jelly filling, if it is baked or fried together with any kind of filling, for example, pizza could be dough with cheese and stuff on it. If it's baked or fried together with the other tastes, then that's mezonos, except that Chabad adds an additional requirement that the dough itself has to be kneaded not with water, but with fruit juice, eggs, oil, wine, anything other than water. Okay, outside of Chabad, even if the dough is kneaded with water, as long as it's baked together with cheese or jelly or whatever, then it's mezonos.
Okay. So the Chabad requirement to have fruit juice is only if it is actually fried with the filling inside.
Correct.
If it's put in afterwards, it's not fried.
If it's put in afterwards, it's hamotzi.
Well, like a dough that's squeezed in the jam afterwards.
Yeah, and the dough itself was basically bread dough kneaded with water, hamotzi lechem min haaretz. Outside of Chabad, it would be mezonos.
So you could come to Chabad, a lot of dough that could then become hamotzi.
Perhaps, but as far as I know, the ordinary sufganiyot, the ordinary jelly-filled donuts sold in the market today, the dough itself is not made with water. The dough itself is made with oil and other stuff, oil, eggs, other stuff. Okay?
Is this from the halacha of Shulchan Aruch, or is it from the Sefer
Brachos? This is the halacha in the Shulchan Aruch of the Baal HaTanya.
Yes. I have a habit of reading before I go to bed.
Oh, no.
If I read the Torah in bed, I have to wear my pants. And so I was wondering, what are the rules regarding reading in bed? Can I not be in my pajamas and be in my clothing for the regular day?
More specifically, who wear pants?
Yeah. I'll tell you in general. First I'll tell you the halacha, and then I'll give you some advice. The halacha is as follows. Aside from tefillah, by tefillah I mean Shmona Esrei, the Amidah, aside from the Amidah, the Shmona Esrei, which is the kernel of tefillah, aside from that, men can engage in kedusha activities as long as their genitals are covered. Genitals covered means not only the genitals themselves have to be covered, but all pubic hair has to be covered as well. If the genitals and all pubic hair are covered, men are permitted to engage in kedusha activities, reciting blessings, learning Torah, reciting Kriya Shema, and so forth and so on. For tefillah, Shmona Esrei, the Amidah, that's Omed Lifnei HaMelech, that's Ki'ilu Omed Keneged HaShechina. I said that backwards. That's Omed Keneged HaShechina, Ki'ilu Omed Lifnei HaMelech. That requires also Yechaseh Et Libo, also the chest has to be covered. Now, that said, it follows that it is permitted to learn Torah as long as you're under a sheet, for example, and the sheet covers the entire genital area, then min hadin. As far as the halacha is concerned, a bracha can be recited, kriya shema can be recited, you can learn Torah all as well. Okay, now what I've formulated up till this point is the halacha, regarding which there is no significant machlokas, no significant disagreement amongst the poskim. Now what I'm going to say now is no longer halacha. What I'm going to say now is an inyan of Hasidus. Of course, if one relates to the kedusha activity that you're doing seriously, someone who relates to kriyashma, reciting a bracha, learning Torah seriously, will of course want to dignify the performance of the mitzvah as much as possible, and that would mean being dressed in a normal, dignified way. So if the question is, are you permitted to recite a bracha, say Kriya Shema, learn Torah, while you are undressed, but under a sheet, covering your genitals, the answer is permitted. And all the great folks can agree to that. Yeah, that's supposed to do.
Is there a set threshold in terms of how functional, how non-corrupt, how well set up the courts are, where it qualifies or doesn't qualify?
The question you ask is a frequently discussed one, but the discussion does not revolve around contemporary non-Jewish societies. The discussion always revolves around the town of Shechem, Nablus, in biblical days. After all, Shechem was a very corrupt town, which did not have a functioning legal system at all. And Shimon and Levi, of the tribes of the Bnei Israel, attacked the city and killed all the people. Rambam says the reason it was justified for them to do that was because the residents of Shechem did not have a valid legal system, and therefore were all guilty of violating one of the Noahide commandments, and were therefore all Chayav Misa, liable to the death penalty for that. That's what the Rambam says. Now, the discussion amongst the poskim around this point goes more or less as follows. It is true that the king, whose name was Shechem, and the judges of the law courts and the leaders of the society were corrupt and did not have any functioning legal system. That's true. And they, therefore, were in violation of the Noahide commandment. But what about the ordinary citizen? What about the ordinary resident? He had no control over matters. I suppose an individual citizen, an individual resident of Tzfat, who wanted to have a functioning legal system, there's nothing he could do about it. And the question, therefore, arises, why ordinary residents were considered to be in violation of the legal system, of not having a legal system. They were anus. They had no control over the situation. Even if they wanted to, there's nothing they could do about it. And the rule should be, onus rahmana patre, people who are unable, simply unable to fulfill a mitzvah. So if you, you don't have to be a great Talmud Chacham to understand that if you can't, you can't, and HaKadosh Baruch Hu cannot expect you to do something which you're simply unable to do. And as far as the ordinary residents of Tzfat are concerned, even if they wanted to improve the situation, there's no way they could have. And someone who's unable to do a mitzvah is surely exempt from the mitzvah. And the question therefore arises why they, the ordinary residents, were liable to the death penalty.
So aside from this story, there hasn't been set up a formal test to actually determine whether a system of laws in any particular government fulfills this command.
Correct.
Or whether we can sort of massacre and join.
Of course, we live in a part of the world where most of our neighbors live in states which are more or less hefker, more or less innocent of any legal structure.
Regarding the secular court?
Yeah, most of our neighbors are do not have well-functioning legal systems. The countries surrounding us, are largely innocent of any functioning legal system. That means they don't have any laws that work. Unfortunately, I mean this affects us very much as well. But that they suffer, one can be sympathetic. But it also makes us suffer, and that's even worse, I suppose. Consider the following idea. According to Rav Chanan Wasserman in the Kovitz Shiurim on Yevamos, and following him, all the other great contemporary authorities fell in line with this idea. Onus, inability to fulfill a mitzvah, exempts a person from the obligation to do the mitzvah only if the person is unhappy about being unable to observe the mitzvah. Someone who is happy about being in a situation where he is unable to fulfill the mitzvah is still reckoned guilty for failing to fulfill the mitzvah. For example, if someone holds a gun to my head and says, "Either eat the pork or I will kill you," well, I have no choice. I have to eat the pork in order to save my life. Now, there are two possibilities. I can either be happy or unhappy about eating the pork. If I'm happy about it, I say, "Oh, finally, I've been looking for an opportunity to taste this stuff. Oh, finally, I have the opportunity. I've really wanted to eat this all the time, and now I can legitimately do it." Well, someone who's happy about violating the mitzvah does not get the benefit of the exemption of being onus, not having any choice. On the other hand, someone who is sad about it, well, of course, I would rather not, but this is the only way I can save my life. That's the person to whom the exemption applies. And therefore, if the people in Shechem or in any other contemporary society are happy with the situation, yes, this is the government we want, even though this government fails in structuring a legal system, then if they're happy about it, then they should also be guilty. If they're unhappy about it but unable to change it, then only the leaders would be guilty. I've not actually defined what constitutes a valid legal system, but let me add the following idea. The following idea has a whole raft of supporters to it. The idea I'm about to tell you originated by Rav Natan HaGaon, Rav Nosson HaGaon, one of the great Gaonim of Babylonia, where he publishes the following opinion on the first page of the Gemara. If you open up the first Masechet, his Brachas, the Gemara begins on the left side. On the facing right side of the page, which is before the Gemara actually begins, there's a tshuva of Rav Nosson Gaon, which formulates the following idea, and this idea is later accepted by many people. The idea is as follows. Seichel Hayashar. What is rationally correct, what reason dictates as being correct is an obligation not only for us Jews, but for Goyim as well. Reason is mechayev. Reason obligates us, and any conclusion which is required by reason, any conclusion which is required by reason is equally obligatory for Jews and non-Jews. And there are many sugyas in the Gemara, there are many halachas in the Gemara which are not derived from any verse in the Torah. There are many halachas in the Gemara which are not derived from any Torah Shabbal Peh, tradition passed on generation after generation since Moshe Rabbeinu. There are many halachas in the Gemara which are derived by force of reason. And this is true of many halachas in financial relations. Those halachas which are derived by force of reason, not because of a pasuk that HaKadosh Baruch Hu commanded us and only us, not because of a tradition going back to Moshe Rabbeinu of Torah Shebaal Peh, which was commanded to the Jewish people and only to the Jewish people. Those elements of halacha which are derived from force of reason, those should be equally applicable to non-Jews. It follows, therefore, that the minimum requirement of a non-Jewish legal system has to be those halachas which reason dictates. Okay.
How do you determine halacha to things like monetary valuation of things that would be sold, markups?
Ask an accountant. They do things like that. It depends why you want to know the value. You want to know the value because someone damaged it and has to pay compensation? Is that the issue?
You're either that or you're looking to go into the business of it and you want to identify what price a lot of people are able to sell it for, taking into account various things.
Yeah. The idea is easy to formulate and difficult to apply. The halacha assumes, and accountants and businessmen might not be so happy with this, but the halacha assumes that there is such a thing as market value. Now, of course, everyone knows that a certain item, which is manufactured in huge quantities in a single factory manufactures millions of a certain item. One knows that exactly that same item you can buy for vastly different prices in different stores as you walk up and down the street. And therefore, in practice, it's not always easy to establish what market value is. I mean, often it is easy to establish market value for a portion of falafel in pita is sold in almost every pita shop for exactly the same price. It's very clear what the market value of that is. For other things, it's not easy at all to establish market value. But that's what you have to try to do. I don't say it's easy. The idea is easy to formulate. To apply might be difficult. Once you've established the market value, so now you know the amount of compensation for someone who has damaged or destroyed that object. And as far as the price which you are going to charge in your shop, you can go up or down from the price. You can raise the price or lower the price from the market standard by 1/6 and still be legitimate. If your price at which you are selling the item is within 1/6, up or down, of the market value, you're okay.
I find it hard to understand, given the fact that if a person is willing to purchase the item and isn't being forced to come from purchasing, what would prevent someone from charging over 1/6?
What about less than 1/6?
Less than 1/6.
In fact, if
he's able to lower his cost,
what do I know about marketing? Only what I read in the newspaper. But there's a very successful, very quickly growing market chain of supermarkets in Israel today, which captured a vast section of the market by selling chickens, fresh chickens, for 1 shekel a kilo. Fresh chickens, 1 shekel a kilo, brought in huge numbers of customers into their store. Obviously, they were losing on every chicken they sold, but they were happy to do that in order to bring the customers into the store, and they were quite successful in establishing quite a successful chain doing this. The idea is as follows. Of course, you can overcharge. Of course, you can undercharge, as long as there is no fraud involved. If you overcharge, you charge double what everyone else is charging up and down the street. Everyone up and down the street has a certain charge for a portion of falafel in pita, and you're selling it for double that price. As long as your customers are not being deceived and not being fooled, as long as the customers know that they can get exactly the same product at another store for half the price, and nonetheless they wish to pay double, and there might be many reasons why they want to do that. Maybe they want to be in your store, maybe it's more convenient for them, maybe they like you, whatever the crazy reason is, if there's no deceit involved, it's okay. Similarly, if you undercharge, and there's no deceit, well, everyone understands that chicken at a shekel a kilo is a loss leader, that there's no deceit involved here, then all is well. The problem is, if the customer buys something thinking that he is paid a reasonable market value, a reasonable market price for what he's gotten, and he comes home and he discovers, I paid far more. I was fooled. I was tricked. I was deceived into paying far more than the market value. Then the sale was not a product of proper meeting of the minds. There was no meeting of the minds here. There's a little bit of deceit, and the sale failed.
The sale
is invalid. And what's the other way as well? I'm selling whatever it is in my store. A customer comes in and sees a specific item on the shelf marked at a very low price, and the customer says to himself, the shopkeeper has made a big mistake here. He didn't realize what this is. It's really worth three times what he's charging for it. I'm going to buy it at the low price that he marked on the item. Well, there's a little bit of deceit here as well. Here it's the shopkeeper who is being fooled. If the price is too low, more than a sixth below the market value, then it's the shopkeeper who's being fooled, unless all the facts are put on the table. If all the facts are on the table and no one's being fooled and everyone still wants the deal the way it is, then that's fine. But if one side or the other is being fooled, the sale is buttled, invalid. The sale is invalid because there's no proper meeting of the minds. The money should go back, the merchandise should go back, and they should start all over again.
What do you do with the bank?
If you want to buy something and you think the item is greatly underpriced, so you should go back and give the item back and get your money back. There's not a whole lot I can do about that. if there's a lot of money involved, you can consult with a lawyer. Yeah.
Three questions on that. One is that it's very good. So someone sees that some things is over and they shop for less than it's actually worth.
Yeah, sure. If I go into an antique shop and I see an antique priced far below true value and I want to buy it, I have to say to the shopkeeper, you realize what this is that you're selling? You thought it's an 18th century blah blah blah. It's really a 17th century blah blah blah. You realize what you're really selling here? And if he says, I want that to be the price, fine, take it.
This is in
our corner of the world, that's becoming rarer and rarer. It's peculiar. When I came to Israel not so long ago, there was no such thing as fixed prices. The haggling was the rule. There's even a Hebrew word for it, l'hitmakeach. L'hitmakeach is what you do when you bargain over a price. In the years that I've been here, that's become rarer and rarer. Israel has more or less made it to European or Western standards, where the only things you haggle in price over are real estate and cars. People still haggle with real estate and cars, but aside from this, we have mostly fixed prices. Now, if someone is setting a price higher than he actually anticipates getting, anticipating that the customers are going to bargain and lower the price. If a customer comes in and buys it at the initial price that was offered, and that initial price is in point of fact more than 1/6 over the market value for this item, then the sale is invalid, and the money should go back, and the merchandise should go back.
And the third question was that I went to Israel, and I saw that Yochanan came to me, and so I got the oil mess, I got the metal things with the wicks, and I asked Shafi Kamashi what it was, and the only reason why I had no idea how much the price would be in any sort of way, the only reason I tried to haggle it down, because I saw him scamming them down, see as American, obviously, and take 10 shekels. I thought this could be, but not likely. And I saw him around later for 5 shekels. So that helped me with him, he did. Have you seen as American trying to take Canada?
No. He sold it to you, he sold to you an object which has a market value of 5 shekels. He sold it to you for 10 shekels. If he would sell it to you for a price more than 1/6 above the market value, the sale is invalid, and it's not right.
Switching gears backwards a little bit, I remember hearing a while ago that thematically, and if this isn't true, then I suppose it is a hypothetical, that they were slowly genetically altering banana trees to last more than a year, because from what I understand, bananas are done because it's considered the one that the tree dies every year. So if it becomes the case that some bananas are actually on the banana tree that doesn't die every year, and the tree stock stays yearly, would we be changing our bracha on bananas from Adam to eight, or would we keep it at Adam because we have a tradition to say Adam?
Yeah, the facts are slightly different than you propose. Banana trees, as you know, are not trees at all. It's kind of grass, banana tree. The banana tree is a kind of grass. Have you ever observed grass growing? As the grass grows, the leaves surround a hollow center. And that's exactly the way banana trees grow. It's not true that banana trees last 1 year. They typically last longer. A banana tree usually lasts two, three years before it has to be cut down and new ones planted. Trees, like banana trees, which do not last beyond 3 years, have the halachic status of being pri ha'adama, and if the tree is genetically altered in a way that it has changed and become permanent, then all of a sudden the laws of Orla will apply to it. At the moment there is no law of Orla pertaining to bananas, but if the trees do are changed so that they do last into the fourth year and beyond, then the laws of Orla will apply and the bracha will change accordingly. And that's a real possibility. No, the rules of Orla at the moment do not apply to bananas because the tree does not last long enough to get out of the state of Orla. That's why it's Bori Pri Adama, not Bori Pri Eitz. Halachically speaking, it's not a tree at all. If it would last 10 years, then the first 3 years the fruit is prohibited, and only in the fourth year it could be redeemed. Correct. Which it doesn't make a whole lot of sense as far as the marketing is concerned. Yes.
What are the areas of Torah that human earth might study according to the choice of the last generation?
Well, as you know, I suppose better than I, from the Chabad point of view, women should be encouraged to study everything, including Gemara. Outside of Chabad, there's a little bit of disagreement on this. Traditionally speaking, until the beginning of the 20th century, traditionally speaking, women were taught only Chumash, biblical texts, simple Midrashim, and those halachas that they needed in order to lead a Jewish life, and nothing more. Over the last century or so, a movement has developed led by the Chafetz Chaim and other great leaders around 100 years ago, a little bit over 100 years ago, to broaden the curriculum taught to women. The idea being that modern women, over the last 100 years, have secular education, and they become secularly educated people. They become lawyers, chemists, and whatever, having secular education. And if their Torah education is left on the primitive level that it had been through the generations, then since they have intellectual engagement in secular matters, but no intellectual engagement in religious matters, that creates a kind of tension which would lead them off the path of Torah. And therefore, nowadays, most poskim agree with teaching even Gemara to women. Let me point out in passing that there's a historical controversy over this issue. Is it correct to establish historical facts by following the majority of historians? You know, like in halacha, the majority of opinions weighs very heavily upon us. But the students of history, all of a sudden, the opinion of the majority of historians doesn't make much sense in historical discussions. In any event, the machlokas, the disagreement is as follows. It is the contention of the Chafetz Chaim that the reason that women in large numbers left Torah Judaism 150 years ago, 100 years ago, the reason there was such a massive abandonment of Torah and mitzvahs by women was because they were uneducated. In earlier generations, women learned in the household what they needed in order to lead Jewish lives. They learned from their mothers and their grandmothers and their aunts what was necessary for kashrus, how to prepare a chicken and soak and salt it, and how to keep milk and meat separate, and taharas hamishpacha, family purity, and everything they learned from the families. 150 years ago, when if you know anything about social history of Europe, 150 years ago was the collapse of families in general. The whole institution of families collapsed in Europe around 150 years ago. Young girls were therefore no longer being educated within the framework of the family, and therefore they would leave Torah Judaism having no Torah education at all through the family unless schools could be set up and the girls could be put into schools where they would get formal education. Formal education was supposed to replace the traditional household education through the ages, according to the Chafetz Chaim and according to those who have that historical perspective of Jewish families. Earlier, the girls learned in the families. Now, they no longer do. We have to put them into school. Yes. Let's just finish with this for a moment. We'll get the other point of view. Here comes the other point of view. The previous Lubavitcher Rebbe, the Riatz, sent, this before World War II, sent shlichim, not all over the world, but pretty far from Poland the shlichim went. There were shlichim which were sent from Poland before World War II to Jewish communities in Morocco, among other places. The shlichim of the previous Rebbe, the Riatz, in Morocco, encountered a problem, which they wrote back to the Rebbe seeking advice about. The problem was as follows. In Morocco, the shliach of Chabad discovered the women knew nothing. The women had not the vaguest idea what the principles of family purity, Taras HaMishpacha, might be. They knew nothing about kashrus. They knew simply nothing about Torah. Well, if the mothers didn't know, and the grandmothers didn't know, and the aunts didn't know, there's no way that the daughter is going to learn in the family. And the shlichim therefore wanted the advice of the Rebbe what to do. The advice of the Rebbe was to open up a school, get the girls out of the families, into a school where they could have organized formal education and learn what they need. Now here we have two opposite views of the traditional Jewish family in Morocco before World War II. Modernity had not yet arrived. Not only did they have no electricity, they had no other forms of modernity had yet arrived in Morocco. That was the traditional way of life, which they were still following in the villages there. And according to the Chabad view, therefore, even in the traditional Jewish family, through the ages, the girls were uneducated. In the Chafetz Chaim's view of things, they were educated through the traditional family, and only with the collapse of the traditional family did schools have to be instituted. Two very different views of Jewish history. What was it about Shmuel Nesvi?
Yeah, I was just going to ask, in Shmuel Nesvi, we pray for the welfare in Baruch Lehner, for the welfare of the produce, and that. And I was just wondering, in the Southern Hemisphere, when you govern, you still say the seasons in the Northern Hemisphere. And I was told that the reason is because you're actually paying for Eretz Yisrael.
Right.
However, when we switch over from Talmud to the same Baruch, there's, you know, outside of Eretz Yisrael, we switch later because the seasons in Israel, but earlier in Israel especially, which would seem to apply that you're praying for your local area, not for Israel, because if you're paying for Israel, you want to switch to time Israel and Israel. So
Yes. Of course you're correct that the tefillah is a tefillah for Eretz Israel, which is why even in the southern hemisphere they follow our schedule for davening for rain, because we're davening for rain in Eretz Israel. The reason to delay the same Talmud Matar a couple of weeks until just now, is because back in those days when they established the text of Shmona Esrei, back in those days the principal Jewish community was located in Babylonia, not in Eretz Israel. And therefore, after the festival, after Sukkot, that starts to rain in Eretz Israel after Sukkot, well, not this year, but that's when it should start to rain. It starts to rain in Eretz Israel after Sukkot, but the pilgrims who had come from Babylonia still had to get back home. And therefore, we don't want to ask for rain while they are still en route back home to Babylonia. And that takes a couple of weeks until they get home. Once they're safely home, now we start asking for rain in Eretz Israel. So the delay in asking for rain does not have to do with Chutz La'aretz in general. It has to do with the situation in those days when they instituted the rules, the time it takes to get from Eretz Israel to Babylonia by caravan. And that principle remains with us today. Now, one of the great authorities, and the following is the unique, unusual view of one of the great authorities, by no means the majority view, unique view of one person, and therefore I wouldn't advise anyone to follow the following view. It's interesting. Here comes the following view. Rav Chaim of Volozhin was the great Rav of Volozhin 150 years ago. And he was asked the following question in the middle of the winter. This time of year, when the Jews in Europe had already started praying for rain, apparently one individual balabas, one individual Jew, forgot daven shacharis and forgot to pray for rain. After shacharis, he came to Rav Chaim of Volozhin, who was the rav of the town, explained what happened, and wanted to know the halacha. Rav Chaim said, "You know that you're supposed to pray for rain in each tefillah. This time you didn't. Still, you're Yotzeh, you fulfilled the obligation of prayer. Just from now on, do it right." And the Balabas left. After the questioner left, the Talmidim turned to Rav Chaim and said, "Why on earth did you tell him that he has to be correct from now on? The halacha is, in the Gemara, and there's no disagreement about this, the halacha is that if you fail to daven for rain when you're supposed to, you're not Yotzei at all, you haven't fulfilled the mitzvah of davening at all, you have to go back and daven shacharis again, and daven mincha again, whatever it is. So why did you tell him that he does not have to repeat?" To which Rav Chaim explained as follows. According to the Gemara, when we daven for rain, we're davening for rain in Eretz Israel. Why do we daven for rain in Eretz Israel? As the Gemara says, Birkat Kol Ha'aretzot Tzuluya Be'eretz Yisrael. The bracha of every country in the world flows out of the bracha which falls upon Eretz Yisrael. If Eretz Yisrael has bracha, if Eretz Yisrael has rain, then that bracha will spread out through the whole world. That's what the Gemara says. Reb Chaim of Elazhin said that was true in those days. But nowadays we see that the Jews here in Russia must send financial contributions in order to support the Jewish community in Eretz Yisrael. Today we see the flow of bracha has reversed direction. Today, bracha flows from Russia to Eretz Yisrael. And we do not need more snow in the winter. And therefore, I told them that he fulfilled the obligation of davening, even though he didn't daven for rain. Well, it's an unusual opinion, but it's an opinion. Yes.
You answered that question before about only being obligated, the halacha is only covering your area,
right,
or being able to say bracha. When you say halacha, would you consider the problem of halachas in Orachai and Shulchan Aruch be halachas in the sense that it seems there's a halacha rule that you can't uncover parts of your body that are normally covered.
You cannot touch parts of the body which are normally covered.
Right, but even in regards to the bathroom, you can't uncover the part of your body for a certain...
Right, because that's the principle of modesty. But someone who has pronounced a bracha or said Kriya Shema or done any Kedusha activity aside from tefillah, with chest uncovered, only wearing trousers, if the question is, has he fulfilled the mitzvah of Kriya Shema? The answer is yes. If the question is, does he have to do tshuva for having done anything wrong? The answer is no. If the question is there probably something wrong? Is there probably something wrong with the way he relates to the Kedusha, the sanctity of the activity in which he's engaged? The answer is probably yes. There probably is something wrong here. If one sleeps without clothes on, and whilst under the sheets you put on pants, and then you stand up and dress the rest of the body, you're guilty of nothing. You're not in violation of any halacha at all.
Right, you're not doing the positive halacha what it told you to do, no?
No, the halacha which requires getting dressed under the sheets is talking about someone who sleeps without clothes on, and therefore, if he stands up, he's wearing nothing. If the person who sleeps with no clothes on puts on pants under the sheets and then stands up, he is guilty of nothing. The right.
What about just by socks? So when you're under the sheets, you should, but if you only sleep without your socks, you have to put your socks back under the sheets.
Yeah, you're speaking about what it says in the Shulchan Aruch Harav.
Yes.
This is of course not in the when you said Shulchan Aruch. I, in my foolishness, thought you meant the Shulchan Aruch. But of course, you're referring to the Shulchan Aruch of the Baal Tanya. Somehow my mind is not oriented in the right direction for a moment. It indeed says that to the Shulchan Aruch of the Baal Tanya, and therefore people who follow the Baal Tanya indeed should be bound by that. That's correct. That's correct. People who are following the Shulchan Aruch of the Baal Tanya should follow that. So we've reached the end of our Shia today. I wish you all a lechtigin and freilich and chanukah, and look forward to seeing you not next week, which will be a break, but the week after.